Well, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, North Korea has renewed activity of suspected nuclear test sites, including the movement of people, vehicles, and material. What is going to happen with all of this? We're going to be talking with Jerome Corsi in just a moment about this situation and about Iran in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Jerry Corsi. Jerome Corsi received a Ph.D. from Harvard University in political science, has written many books and articles, and is an expert on political violence, terrorism. In 1981, he received a top secret clearance from the Agency for International Development, where he assisted in providing anti-terrorism hostage survival training to embassy personnel. In 2005, Dr. Corsi helped found and launch the Iran Freedom Foundation, which is a not-for-profit educational and charitable organization established to educate all of us about the Islamic Republic of Iran and to promote freedom in the region. Generally, Jerry pops on for a news quick break for us, but this time it's a complete show. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
George, great honor to be with you. Thank you.
Got so excited you're going to be on the whole program tonight. I even got tongue-tied about it,
Jerry. Well, George, it's a great honor to be on for the whole show. I look forward to it.
We're going to talk about very soon your new work about Iran and what's happening there. But let's get your reaction to North Korea, Jerry, because they are rapidly renewing activity of their suspected nuclear test sites. And you know what? It appears that something's going to happen there.
Well, it does, George. Last July, and I'm sure many listeners will recall, North Korea launched a test firing of 7 missiles. They test fired even their long-range Taipodong missile, which could hit the United States. And this was, again, a time when North Korea threatened to fire these missiles. We went on alert. We said we would try to shoot some down with our anti-missile system, which we did not do. But the 7 missiles were launched. Some were successful, some were not. They landed largely in the Sea of Japan. And now North Korea is threatening to test a nuclear weapon, which there's good reason to believe they have at least 13 of. And if they did that, it would be another escalation of the nuclear crisis with North Korea and also have implications on Iran.
Are we going to allow North Korea to launch a test, a nuclear test?
Well, George, we may not have any alternative but to allow them to do it. I mean, Secretary Rice, who is in the Middle East right now, made some very strong statements today threatening North Korea and warning North Korea not to try this. But quite frankly, I don't see how we could stop North Korea if they were determined, just like last July, to launch missiles. They may now try to detonate and demonstrate a nuclear weapon. There'd be really nothing we could do, George, to stop them.
Do we know where this detonation would take place, Jerry?
We would have some pretty good ideas, and our satellites, I'm sure, are now watching very carefully over North Korea to see activity if they would prepare a test site. And so far, I've not seen any indications in the press or the many intelligence internet sites I watch. There's actually a site prepared. There's some discussion this may be just a threat to do a nuclear test. But again, that was the kind of discussion that occurred last July, and then North Korea went ahead and did fire weapons. They launched their missiles and showed they had them, and they were successful, many of them. So I think, George, right now it's 50-50. I think they could actually launch a test of a nuclear weapon, and it could be a demonstration that would and should scare the world.
Aside from us, what do you think the Japanese would do?
Well, you've got a great point, George, because the Japanese are right there, and also the Chinese. I mean, there's a lot of discussion that the North Koreans are really a client state of the Red Chinese.
Right.
And the Red China and Japan are very important in supplying North Korea. Kim Jong-il, the ruler of North Korea, has acted like an extortionist. I mean, he makes these threats. He's cut off the multi-party talks that have been going on. The United States have not engaged in direct talks with him, but there's a six nation talks going on. He's cut those off. And his country is desperately poor. North Korea is in total disarray. And Kim Jong-il makes these military demonstrations, often like an extortionist, to get more economic aid to prop up his really failing regime in a population that's horribly depressed.
Jerry, isn't it amazing how we continually, as a nation, as a United Nations, bounce back between Iran and North Korea? Just when one gets hot, the other seems to cool down. Then the other one gets hot, the other country seems to cool down.
Well, it's a very good observation, George, and you're right. North Korea and Iran, over the last few decades, have worked together. I mean, the Shahab missile that Iran has was really based on a design of the original Nodong missile that North Korea has. And last July, when North Korea launched these tests of their various missiles, there were technical observers from Iran present in North Korea watching what went on. The two countries are working together, and they both feel at this point, I think, that the United States is relatively weak, that we're hamstrung in Iraq, and that there's really very little we can do to stop either Iran or North Korea from advancing their nuclear programs.
Let's go through the countries, Jerry, that have the nuclear capability right now, okay? We got United States. We have Russia. I'm going to ask you a question about Russia in a second. We have Israel. We have India. We have Pakistan. We have China. Are there any other countries that possess a nuclear weapon that we know of? I mean, does Japan? I don't know.
Japan does not at this point, okay, as far as we know. And you've really defined the countries that are known to have nuclear weapons. We know that Iran is working on a nuclear weapon. I mean, even the International Atomic Energy Agency in their recent reports have documented that Iran is working on a secret program that is a weapons program. But Iran has not yet achieved the ability to enrich uranium to weapons grade. They're working at it hard at Natanz, but they've not achieved that ability yet. So, George, you really defined the nuclear club right there.
What about the former Soviet republics, which are now their own little countries, besides the big Russia? What about all those little splinter countries? Do they, in the fact that they were part of the Soviet Union, do any of them have nuclear capabilities that we may not be publicly aware of?
Well, it's also a very good question, George. You know, the Ukraine has had nuclear weapons that were ex-Soviet Union nuclear weapons, and there's been considerable debate internationally whether all of the Russian weapons have been accounted for. There's even reports that the Ukraine last year sold some nuclear weapons in the form of cruise missiles to Iran. Now, none of this has really been validated in a solid way internationally, but various of the republics we know had Russian nuclear weapons placed on their soil in their control when the Soviet Union was intact, and we've not been able to establish that the Soviet Union has got a complete inventory all under their control and under the current configuration of Russia and Putin.
Well, you know, we either, these emerging countries with the potential of nuclear capability, we either let them do it, we either negotiate our way where they don't do it and they get paid off for it, or we attack them. What other options are left?
Well, again, George, you've defined the options, and it's a very difficult situation because with countries like Iran that we've engaged in negotiations with, Iran knows, and there's good history. I mean, Pakistan and Israel are two good examples where countries defying the international sanctions and the international negotiations, proceeding on their own track to develop nuclear weapons, have succeeded. And there's nothing that has been done by the world community to stop them. So Iran sees that both Israel and Pakistan succeeded, India succeeded, China and Russia going back decades. And by the way, always with U.S. intelligence underestimating the amount of saying, oh, take them much longer than it would take. I don't think U.S. intelligence has ever correctly predicted any country when they would develop nuclear weapons, going back to when the Soviet Union was the second country in the nuclear club. U.S. intelligence has always been wrong.
Well, now let's getting back to some of these countries then. If North Korea gets the nuke if Iran gets the nuke, regardless of what Ahmadinejad has said about blowing Israel off the face of the map, what country would let a nuke go? Or is the real concern giving them the capabilities so they would sell it to, like, Al-Qaeda, and then they would try to smuggle one into the country?
Well, I
think that's probably the biggest problem.
Well, you're right, George. And, you know, Al-Qaeda has actively been on the market for a nuclear weapon for a long time. That report has been confirmed. And if Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, Iran would certainly say to Al-Qaeda, you could purchase one here. There are Hezbollah cells we know are in the United States. Some Hezbollah agents who got in through Mexico, bribing Mexican officials in Beirut, are in federal prison. They were in Dearborn, Michigan, set up shop, sending money back to Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. So, and the 9/11 Commission report, pages 240, 241, documents that even the muscle 9/11 terrorists got into the United States by Hezbollah working together with Al-Qaeda, and they were brought in through Iran. So these networks of terror groups, kind of working like criminal mafias, could easily work together to take an Iranian nuclear weapon and try to get it into the United States.
So I think that's the big problem. That's the bigger issue. I don't think it's the arming with missiles these countries. I think it's the fact, who will they give, who will they sell their technology to in the future?
Well, you're right, George. I mean, North Korea has, you know, this Taipodong missile could reach the United States. But we know that...
Los Angeles, right? And maybe Hawaii?
Yes, certainly Hawaii and Los Angeles. It could possibly reach a little bit into the interior of the U.S. It's not been tested successfully at those ranges. But, you know, North Korea has missiles and nuclear weapons today, and we don't feel a threat in the United States that North Korea is going to attack us. Iran is kind of a different situation. And
well, first of all, though, North Korea, let's assume North Korea sent a nuke and it hit Los Angeles, and I'm knocked off the air one way or another. But let's assume they do that. They've got to understand, Jerry, that we're going to retaliate and obliterate the country.
Yes, and I think in North Korea that has made an impact, because I think North Korea would be ruled by the MAD, the mutually assured destruction psychology that really has dominated the thinking of the United States and Russia, the United States and China, going back decades. I mean, it's virtually like John Kennedy said, you know, the Russians are like us, they want to grow old, they want to see their children grow successfully. Well, when you can calculate on that, then there's a rationality in the other country. And even Kim Jong-il, well, he has demonstrated many crazy characteristics, has not demonstrated suicidal tendencies. So I think mutually assured destruction applies in countries like North Korea. Whether it would apply in all countries, including Iran, I think is a much more difficult question.
And that's hence the book, The Showdown with the Nuclear Iran, which we'll talk about in just a moment. What other problems or trouble spots are there beyond Iran and North Korea?
Well, those are the two major nuclear trouble spots. But you've got to see that, you know, going back to when President Bush declared the original axis of evil, which included at that time Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, these countries have had surrogate and other terrorist groups that are affiliated with them. I mean, Iran has supported and created and supported Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hamas now is being funded in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Authority, by Iran. North Korea has worked with rogue countries around the world to sell nuclear technology, even Pakistan with A.Q. Khan, who's the father of Pakistan's nuclear program, created a nuclear black market where countries could buy nuclear technology and nuclear plans. I mean, the rogue states and states that want to oppose the United States or the other major powers have been on a nuclear black market. At one point, it even included South Africa that was looking to pursue and develop nuclear programs. South Africa stepped down from that determination, But for a number of years, they were in the club looking for nuclear arms and nuclear development capabilities.
What if A.Q. Khan sold his technology, and we know he did, he only got his hand slapped, Jerry. Why isn't this guy arrested? Why hasn't he been taken out of the country and brought over here? I mean, he's basically, you know, under so-called house arrest, but he's living the life of Riley.
Well, you're exactly right, George. A.Q. Khan is really treated with respect in Pakistan. He's not been arrested or tried. Pakistan itself is a very difficult country. I mean, Musharraf, who was here in the United States just recently and has a book that's a bestseller. In fact, at the press conference with George Bush, he wouldn't answer a couple of questions, saying you had to wait and read the book.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, you've got Pakistan that has recently declared that a whole section of northern Pakistan, the Pakistani army is going to pull out and essentially abandon this mountainous region to the control of the Taliban. And the Taliban is resurgent. It's beginning to exert more authority and power again within Afghanistan, even though we have troops in Afghanistan. I mean, these are very determined, especially the Islamic enemies here in Pakistan, Iran, and that area of the world are very determined enemies. And the idea that we're going to introduce democracy into this region is a long stretch. There's no history of democracy anywhere in this region, or except for Israel. Israel's a democratic country. But other than that, there's no history of these countries being democratic, and Islam itself has not been a democratic religion. I think it's compatible with democracy, but the history of Islamic states have been more authoritarian, more likely to be theocracies than democratic states.
What do you recommend as far as North Korea is concerned?
Well, North Korea, I really think, needs to be negotiated with, and with their economic dependence upon China and Japan, I think there's good leverage over North Korea. I'm against a military solution with North Korea. I think that would be disastrous. We've got a massive force in South Korea. South Korea is very well armed themselves, without nuclear arms, but very strong in a conventional capacity. I just don't think invading or attacking North Korea is a solution. Again, the people of North Korea are oppressed. They would, if they could, overthrow this Kim Jong-il dictator. And I think we play into Kim Jong-il and strengthen him if we threaten him with military retaliation.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Jerry, tell me a little bit about Showdown with Nuclear Iran, then we'll talk about it for the rest of the show.
Well, thank you, George. I've written this book with Michael Evans. As you know, I wrote Atomic Iran first on Iran, and mm-hmm. Michael Evans has had a long and distinguished history for decades, three decades, of working with top Israeli officials. He's been an active force in the entire support of Israel within the United States and around the world. And I wanted to assist Michael in communicating. We had the direct assistance of many authorities within Israel. So we had excellent analysis with the top Israeli defense forces and intelligence estimates of Iran. And I think the book, we determined to write a book that was accessible and very readable for the public to try to explain and explore this new threat of the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, this messianic figure that Islamic Shiites hold so much in reverence, Ahmadinejad, believing that this lost figure who went down a well in 941 A.D. is going to come back in a second coming and have Islam triumph. And we wrote the book to explore that belief of Shiite Islam and what impact it's going to have on Iran.
All right, we'll talk about all that when we come right back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, you know, we're giving 14 issues for the price of 12 with the After Dark newsletter. A couple ways you can take advantage of that and join the very growing list of members who are getting this and love it. 1-888-727-5505. Go online, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Jerry Corsi. Jerry Oran, let's talk a little bit, first of all, about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. What the heck's going on with this guy?
Well, Ahmadinejad is a longtime radical. He is a very serious politician. He is not a nutcase. He's a very serious, long-term expert. If you look back at his history, right now he's threatening, of course, Israel. He says Israel needs to be wiped off the face of the earth. He's denying the Holocaust existed. They're pursuing nuclear weapons in Iran. And as we'll explore here, George, they believe there's a messianic figure, like a second coming, that of this Mahdi who will come back if an apocalypse can be created. But just in exploring who Ahmadinejad is, he has a doctorate from universities in Iran, and what his doctorate is in is he's a traffic engineer. He is an expert in traffic engineering. He was mayor of Tehran. He is not wealthy like many of the mullahs who have become millionaires and billionaires, the mullahs being the clerics who rule Iran. Ahmadinejad lives in a simple apartment within Tehran. He drives an old car.
Is it guarded? I mean, does this guy just come and go, Jerry, as he wants by himself?
He's guarded, although he has lived a very open life until recently. He's, and again, in Iran, the regime is wildly unpopular. I'd say there's really only 20% of the population of Iran that truly supports this regime. The Orthodox and tend to be the poorer and more peasant section of Iran that support Ahmadinejad and the radical, ultra-conservative brand of Shiite Islam that Ahmadinejad professes. But still, you know, George, it's very different for Ahmadinejad to be this kind of a relatively poor individual, not aspired to wealth, but yet extremely zealot. I mean, he was a member of the Revolutionary Guards back in 1979 when he was a young man during Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution.
I mean, was he at the U.S. Embassy? There's been talk that he was one of the hostage takers.
Yes, and George, even recently, even the last few weeks, six or seven of the hostages, U.S. Embassy hostages who were held for 444 days when Jimmy Carter was president, they've again claimed that Ahmadinejad was one of their hostage takers.
And then we should have arrested him, Jerry, the minute he stepped foot in the United States to go to the United Nations.
And, George, I was there at the United Nations photographing and watching and talking to the protesters. There were thousands of Iranians. You know, there's over a million Iranian expatriates in California. Very successful people, raised great families.
Oh, sure.
They adapted to the United States tremendously, and they're horribly upset with the crimes that this, you know, Iranian regime has committed against the people of Iran, and Ahmadinejad's personal involvement with the Revolutionary Guard, going back to 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution. They were appalled that with his human rights violations, that he would be allowed into the United States to speak with honor at the United Nations.
You know what's so sad, Jerry, is that the Shah of Iran probably was as big a violator of human rights in Iran, but the fact that he played ball with us, nobody seemed to care.
Well, and you've got a very good point, George. We've got to remember that when Ayatollah Khomeini first came in February 1st, 1979, from Paris to return from exile back into Iran, Jimmy Carter was president, and Jimmy Carter had shunned the Shah. He'd refused the Shah exile in the United States. And Jimmy Carter at least initially embraced Ayatollah Khomeini as a breath of freedom in the region until, of course, Ayatollah Khomeini entered Tehran, took over the government, and then the revolutionaries, the students under Ayatollah Khomeini, seized our U.S. embassy and took our embassy personnel hostage. And, of course, then Jimmy Carter had to revise his estimate.
That also cost him his reelection.
Yes, you're exactly right, because Ayatollah Khomeini, in keeping those hostages 444 days, and George, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember, and I have to include myself in that group, remember the, you know, news broadcast day after day.
Every day.
354 days.
It's what made Nightline and Ted Koppel.
Yes, it did. That's exactly right. And the horribly failed mission when we sent helicopters into the desert and they collided with the C-130s, and we had dead military U.S. personnel in the desert trying to rescue our hostages and photographed by Ayatollah Khomeini. This was, you know, just a few years after the fall of Saigon. It was truly a low point for the United States of America during Jimmy Carter's presidency and for the U.S. military.
Why? I want to talk about the Shah for a little bit because, you know, there's a history of Iran that a lot of people need to be made aware of. And again, our policies tend to go with people who support us, which is fine. However, we turn our cheek, Jerry, regardless of what these people do to their own people. I mean, they do commit atrocities as well. Saddam Hussein, whom we supported, committed atrocities. We turned on him. Manuel Noriega, we supported him. Then when he didn't play ball with us, we turned on him. None of these people were good Boy Scouts by any means. Why did we permit the Shah of Iran to do what he did with his organization? What was it called? SAVAK, which was as bad a undercover intelligence agency as you can get in terms of butchery. Why did we allow him to do that?
Well, George, I think you put your finger on it because you're right. The United States has given a pass to many brutal dictators and rulers of countries because they supported us. And SAVAK, which was the secret police in Iran under the Shah, was hated, was brutal, was suppressive. And the Shah was not any great winner on human rights within his country.
That's why he was toppled.
Well, that's exactly right. The people of Iran were, you know, resisted him and wanted greater freedoms. They wanted a greater return of power back to the people of Iran. The people of Iran have always wanted that. And the Shah, at the end of his reign, had lost touch with the people of Iran. We still supported the Shah largely. In fact, going back even to the Eisenhower administration, we had originally encouraged the Shah to develop nuclear energy. That has gone on for decades in U.S. policy. U.S. policy with regards to Iran is nothing to brag about going back into the 1950s. We're still struggling over Mossadegh, who was a prime minister in the 50s in Iran, who wanted to nationalize the oil, and the CIA participated in a coup to topple him. That's remembered worldwide and in Iran. It is a black mark on U.S. history in Iran that we've never totally been able to erase. And the Shah the Shah's son is living in the United States near Washington, D.C.
Right. He's a good tennis player. A friend of mine plays tennis with him.
And he has a huge following worldwide, George, for many Iranian expatriates who view him as the next ruler of Iran. And again, so it's a very mixed picture from the Shah and his family, even within Iran. There are many who yet remain loyal and see the return of the Shah's son as the next future for Iran.
Well, and he seems to be a little more benevolent than his father.
Well, certainly he's a very different person, and I've never met him personally, but I've observed him and watched him, read his writings. He seems to be very much more westernized and have a very different personality than his father did. And I can see what the Iranian expatriates see in the Shah's son as a person who would be the continuation of a tradition within Iran that was revered by many Iranians, and very likely a ruler, if he did come back, who would not rule with the iron hand that his father ruled with.
No, you wouldn't be able to sustain yourself. Does he even have a job, Jerry? How does a guy exist?
Well, that's a good question also, George. He exists. There's a lot of support in the Iranian community for him. I think he has had various jobs and consultancies and affiliations that have given him revenue, and the Iranian community supports him. But he has been an international personality, and whenever crises occur within Iran, the Shah's son is on the radio broadcasts that come from California, the expatriate, largely illegal broadcasts in Iran, which have been extremely powerful as a way to communicate into Iran. Some of the radio stations broadcasting there have been very successful, a great personal expense to the people who have run them and operated them. I've broadcast over them. And I truly respect the efforts that are made by the Iranian expatriate community around the world who love their country and want to see freedom restored in Iran.
Well, you know, the Shah's son, Pahlavi, I guess is his
Pahlavi,
last name.
Pahlavi, yes, exactly.
He thinks that something will happen internally, and that, I think, is what he's waiting for.
Well, and you know, George, one of the reasons I created the Iran Freedom Foundation, and you remember I walked 200 miles personally from the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., with a group of very strong and brave expatriates from Iran. And we were broadcasting using these radio and television stations in California and around the country into Iran with a message of freedom. And it's been a great disappointment to me that the State Department has not yet declared regime change. You know, Senator Santorum and Senator Brownback have had millions of dollars to the State Department to support groups that want to create democratic change and peaceful change within Iran. And the State Department has largely sat on that money. Just recently, an Iran Support for Freedom bill got passed by the Congress and signed by the President. Senator Santorum and Senator Brownback very strongly in support of it again. And maybe the State Department will come around. I've always believed there could be a Ukrainian-style peaceful change that would occur within Iran, and it would be by far the best solution. I mean, I've dedicated a significant part of my life and writings to promoting that theme.
And you've been there, haven't you?
I've never personally been to Iran. I've been
really? Okay.
No, it's always been. I think I'm probably too controversial a figure to go to Iran. I'm well known from that march. I speak out strongly in support of Iranian freedom. I have great dedication to many of the Iranian people around the world who have formed groups and within the United States. I've written about them, actively supported them. And I'm sure it's always just been too controversial for me to go to Iran. And I'd love to go to Iran, but I'd like to go to a free Iran.
Now back to Ahmadinejad. If this guy had stopped his rhetoric about Israel and it didn't even go there, would he have had more support?
Oh, certainly, George. I mean, it's been a complete mystery to me why Ahmadinejad, except for what we will talk about with this Mahdi and his zealous religious beliefs, why he's been so talking like Hitler in the face of Israel. I mean, this is the type of dialogue, saying that Israel has no right to exist, that the Holocaust never happened, that if it did happen, then Israel needs to be moved and reestablished in Europe, which is a fantasy idea. And this in-your-face rhetoric against Israel, using many of the exact same dialogues and literature that Adolf Hitler used, pushes the buttons of Israel and the entire generation that survived the Holocaust and created Israel itself. That generation that in the 1940s managed to survive, and there were very few Jews who managed to survive get to Israel after the Holocaust in Europe, Nazi Germany. Those who came out of Europe said never again. They had learned in the Warsaw Ghetto uprising against the Nazis that waiting for other countries to come to the defense of Jews was not going to happen, and that the Jews needed to be strong in their own defense. Israel was created with that thought. And Ahmadinejad threatening the existence of Israel pushes those buttons of fear and existential concern about survival in Israel. If Ahmadinejad would just back off from that rhetoric, I think the world could relax and think we could work with him. But while he stays on that rhetoric, it's very dangerous to assume we can work with him.
Well, and the mullahs must be endorsing whatever he says.
Well, they do. Exactly right, George. The mullahs have to support whomever is the president, or he wouldn't be the president. And Ahmadinejad has a lot of support from Ayatollah Yazdi, whom they call the crocodile. They call him that in part because his name sounds like crocodile in Farsi, and in part, I'm told, because his facial features resemble a crocodile, if you can believe it. And he's very extreme, radical Ayatollah, who was actually one of the major supporters for Khamenei, the current supreme leader. So Ayatollah Yazdi and the other clerics have back behind Ahmadinejad, and there's been a second revolution going on within Iran right now, more zealot, more ultra-conservative, really trying to complete the prophecies and the work that Ayatollah Khomeini had set out in 1979.
All right, let's look now at the Mahdi, as Ahmadinejad believes will come, the second coming in the Islamic Messiah. Do they have a timetable for this, Jerry?
Oh, yes. Ahmadinejad has said, you know, publicly and in international forums that he believes within the next 2 years, Ahmadinejad believes he'll fulfill his personal divine mission, which is to cause the Mahdi to return. And that includes causing an international apocalypse, which is the precondition the believers of the Mahdi think has to happen before the Mahdi will return.
It's amazing. Amazing what they think. Oh, my gosh.
George, this is a very, I mean, even though to people hearing this, this has got to say sound crazy. The belief is a very real belief. The Mahdi is the 12th imam, the 12th grandson of the prophet Muhammad. And in 941, they say he went down a well as a young child. And this well is in the Jamkaran Mosque, which is near Qom in southwest Iran. And they believe he went into hiding, reclusion, occultation, hiding, just like, you know, hidden behind a cloud, still
right.
Alive but hidden. And they believe he'll come back out of that well when the conditions are right, when an apocalypse occurs. And when he comes out of that well, Shiite Islam will triumph worldwide because it will reestablish the line of succession, which the Shiites believe is only the legitimate line coming from the Prophet Muhammad and his family. Ali, who was the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, was killed by an Islamic army. And the son of Ali, Hussein, was killed in a famous battle by another Islamic army. So these two descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, his family, are great martyrs and heroes in Shiite Islam. And the Mahdi is the last of these family figures, and the one mystically that this sect, Ahmadinejad, has put all their belief on, that he will return out of that well and Shiite Islam will triumph, including over the Sunnis, like the Saudis, who believe that secular leaders are the original and right line of succession from the Prophet Muhammad, the caliphates.
Do you believe, Jerry, that Iran is working toward obtaining nuclear weapons?
Yes, I do, George. There has been too much evidence. You know, I've read for years the reports coming out of the International Atomic Energy Agency of the UN, and that's an international group that's actually been very supportive of Iran. But opposition groups like this MEK, the Mujahideen within Iran, they were a sect themselves and a communist sect. They were expelled from Iran by Ayatollah Khomeini. They've made many revelations of Iran's nuclear program for weapons, and they've been validated by the world community, but not disclosed by Iran until the opposition group revealed them.
Well, will there be a preemptive war in Iran? A strike? We'll find out from Jerry Corsi in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.